Actor Charlie Sheen has been waging a very public battle with CBS. The network canceled his show Two and a Half Men after too many tabloid headlines. The actor claims he's cured himself of addiction with the power of his mind, excoriating the 12-step program AA. His father, Martin Sheen, who attributes his sobriety to AA, has asked people to pray for his son. It's a scene played out much less publicly in millions of families, leading researchers to ask, what role does genetics play in alcoholism? Sons of alcoholic fathers are 9 times more likely to develop drinking problems than the general population. Children of alcoholic parents, 4 times more likely. To some, the fact that it may be genetic sounds depressingly fatalistic or like an excuse. But what if targeting genetic links could mean identifying drugs to treat alcoholics based on their DNA? We already know that about 40% of people of East Asian descent carry a preventive gene that makes them nauseous when they drink. It's the so-called Asian flush, again, a deterrent to drinking that's mimicked in the medication Antabuse. Dr. Bankerle Johnson is chair of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia. He joins us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville. And, Doctor, how much do you think genetics is a role in alcoholism?
Roughly about 60% of the components that are inherited or are expressed in order to make someone an alcoholic are probably of genetic origin. But what is very important then is that if you know that approximately 60% of the disease has a biological component, surely then you would reach the conclusion that you could find a biological or a genetic answer towards treatment for alcoholism.
Here's a stat that jumped out at us. Even babies of alcoholics who are adopted into non-drinking homes have nearly the same risk of alcoholism as if they'd stayed with their biological drinking parents. That's pretty astonishing.
That is pretty astonishing. And in fact, what it is telling you is how compelling the biology of the disease is. If I said to someone with a chronic disease like high blood pressure or diabetes that, you know, this disease called alcoholism, you know, it's as biological as these diseases, most people will say, gosh, I didn't know that. And that is very, very important as a message, because we don't blame people who have high blood pressure for having high blood pressure. We don't blame people who have asthma for exacerbating their asthma. Yet all of these diseases have similar genetic and biological contributions as alcoholism.
Well, tell us some more of the evidence that researchers such as yourself have of that. We understand there was a recent study in Nature that found a very rare variant in the H2R2B gene linked to severe impulsiveness. And they found it almost exclusively in Finnish people who were alcoholics.
One of the important components of this, it tells you that not only is impulsivity a component of the disease, but impulsivity might also be a subtype of an alcoholism disease. One of the fascinating things we're learning in genetics is not to think of alcoholism as one disease, but probably several different diseases in which different types of genetics can play a part in determining what type of the disease you get.
This is what makes it so tricky. There's not just one gene.
There isn't just one gene, but that might actually hold the clue. It would obviously be nice if we had just one gene and one answer, but by having various genes, it tells us there are probably various diseases that are alcoholism. Let me expand a bit on that. We all know that there are certain people who may have a drinking problem. They can go for help, and sometimes they get better. We know people who go for help for their drinking problem and don't seem to get better, and we know some people who really get worse. And all those types of people may actually be different types of alcoholism, and at the current time, we treat them all the same. By genetics, what the hope is we'll be able to identify people who can respond to certain types of treatment. So some people may respond even better to talking. Some people may respond better to a medicine. Some people in the future may actually be given gene therapy. So it's very important to know who those individuals are and what type of responses you're likely to get from treatment.
Well, for instance, we understand researchers at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, have tentative in some cases work, identified a tipsy gene that makes carriers of that gene feel inebriated even when they've only had one or two drinks.
Well, that's a protective gene, and those people are often self-identified. You know, they're people who go in social settings, you know, they're easily intoxicated, so they drink small amounts of alcohol. So basically, they have a natural protection against developing alcohol dependence.
Well, and then would the goal be to develop a drug that would mimic that protective gene?
We haven't actually taken that approach, but that would be an interesting way of doing it, so that an individual, once they've had one drink, would not want to have a second or a third or a fourth. But the current direction with anti-craving drugs is actually quite similar, because what it's doing is removing the buzz from individuals who are drinking, so they don't feel like taking a second drink. And this is a natural stopping mechanism for most of those individuals in terms of their drinking patterns.
Is this the drug onadazepam?
Yes, there's a drug onadazepam. And what I think is really exciting about this type of work is when I started to work in this area about 20 years ago, there really were very few drug targets. In fact, the only drug you could take was disulfiram, which basically made you sick if you drank.
That's antabuse.
That's antabuse, mm-hmm. Yes. And now we do have an array of various different drugs really targeting craving. And what is interesting about a pharmacogenetic approach or a genetic approach is you can have a blood test. The blood test can be used to determine whether you're a person likely to respond to the medication, and only if you're likely to respond are you given the medication. And for those who get the medication, the chances of them doing well on the medication are very high. So that's really quite important.
And who does well with this medication? We understand there's a tie to a gene related to serotonin.
Yes, this is a gene in the serotonin system. Really, there are two parts of the gene. One part of the gene is in an area called the promoter region, which really starts off the translational process of the DNA. The second is in the three untranslated section, which determines basically how the gene works or expresses itself. So this is actually a nice discovery of two parts of a gene working together. They're not linked in the genetic sense, but they're pharmacologically linked. So it was really quite nice to make that kind of a discovery.
Well, and that might also help people who, for instance, have taken antabuse and it hasn't been successful. It maybe has made them sick, but then they still go back to drinking no matter how sick it makes them. It sounds like what you're saying is that because of this thinking that there's all different kinds of genes that might produce alcoholism, what works for one person might not work for someone else. And if someone knows that going in, they're far less likely to have a failure, which will set them back even more.
Robin, you make a great point, because no one really wants to give someone who has alcoholism, alcohol dependence, a treatment which might not work or might be hit and miss. So you really want to be socially responsible and find the best treatment for the individual and give them the best chance of recovering from the illness.
We've been talking to Dr. Bankole Johnson, who's the chair of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia. He's looking at targeting genes that may trigger drinking behavior. And Dr. Johnson, let's say someone takes a blood test and finds that they have the gene variations that you've found that may make them vulnerable to alcoholism. And they may be a candidate for taking a drug like the one we've been talking about, ondansetron. That, you say, that person can literally go to a doctor and then after a blood test, if they qualify, get medication and see effects the next day. That sounds almost too easy.
Well, the effect is not exactly quite the next day. It takes a few weeks to build up the full response to the medication. So it really is a very specific type of treatment, and it really changes, I think, the perception of how addictive disorders can be treated in general.
Well, and we should note that you have a financial stake in a company that hopes to develop ondansetron as an alcohol treatment, which opens up a potential bonanza for that company, considering how many alcoholics there are. If this were true, this would be a lifesaver for some people.
It does have the capacity or capability of opening up really new vistas in the way we approach people with addictions and maybe destigmatize a little bit the alcoholism disease. I think that if individuals realized that the alcoholism disease is not just one of a personal and social failure, but also one in which genetics may be playing a part, then they might feel a little bit more, empowered to take the individual to see a doctor to get checked up. And in fact, that is a very important take-home message, I think, for your listeners to have.
We have had this conversation before, and as you know, it can be a controversial one. What do you say to the people who have a firm belief in 12-step programs and who believe that any medication, it becomes like a quick fix that wears off after a while. I guess I'm going back to anabuse and the fact that it wears off for some people, because they believe that it's not a matter of just stopping the drinking. It's changing a whole bunch of things about a person, and that takes, you know, the 12-step sort of stripping down program.
I'm old enough to probably remember medicine in the 60s. And in the 50s and the 60s, there were very few antidepressants that really worked very well in terms of having a low side effect profile and were tolerable. And what we used to teach, or what was taught in medical schools at that point in time, was that if you took an antidepressant, it was really a crutch. And you really had to go through psychotherapy. A lot of people had their own psychoanalysts. And that really was the world of psychiatry. Today, if you have a depressive illness, I doubt that you'll find a psychiatrist who is going to tell you that you need to go and do psychoanalysis and not take an antidepressant. So what tends to happen is medicine tends to reveal ways in which diseases might have better or more optimal treatments. And I think that that is really the take-home message. Now, so the individual who chooses to go to any kind of a 12-step program or a self-help program or some kind of psychological program is not barred from doing it. They can do that, but they would do themselves a power of good if they can respond to medicine to have the medicine as well.
And as you know, that's controversial within AA circles. But putting that aside, I can hear someone saying, yeah, but a person who's severely depressed would welcome a change to that, would welcome the medication. Very often an alcoholic, no matter how low, does not ultimately want to change the situation. Does having, you know, pills or medication overcome that? The person who, no matter how bad it is, really doesn't, you know, because it's addictive as opposed to depression. It's addictive behavior. They don't want to give it up.
No one is born as a baby and says, well, gosh, you know what I'd like to do with my life is I'd love to be an addict. And no child growing up says to himself, well, I'd love to be an addict. So if there was a way in which an individual can have a treatment for their addiction and they believe that the treatment was likely to work, you would open up the possibility that individuals would want treatment. In fact, they would demand treatment.
And are you talking about treatment before this becomes a problem?
I'm talking about treatment once the disease is recognized. But there's also an important component of prevention. And our prevention is very important as an education plan in schools and in people who know they're vulnerable in order to plan for the future and decide what to do.
So do you think that parents should test their children?
We're not quite at the stage of putting together all the genes yet. So I think that it will be a little premature. But the time at which we may be able to test individuals to determine whether they might respond to a medicine is definitely here. And I think that the prevention component is going to follow fast on its heels over the next few years. We'll learn so much more.
That's Professor Bankole Johnson, Chair of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.